Well, when I was hearing Dave talk about longevity, it reminded me of a story about the Caltech football team, which is, this fellow went to see his doctor, and a doctor says, well, I've got some good news and some bad news. And the bad news is you only got 6 months to live. But the good news is if you move to Pasadena and become a Caltech football fan, that 6 months will seem like eternity. And we are talking about longevity. It turns out that we human beings are the longest living creatures on the planet if you count longevity by activity and heartbeats. Compared to most mammals on the planet, we can have about four times as many heartbeats as other animals. Although animals that do come close to us would be like the elephant, the whale. The tortoise is way behind, and that's just because the tortoise has a very low metabolism, doesn't do much. So again, I guess that's a good measure for us. You can live a long time, but are you really going to do anything with all those years? So high activity will typically lower your life a little bit, but yes. Well, my guess is that whale that lived to be 200 is one of these whales that is a vegetarian, takes in or the krill, and just and those creatures have a much lower metabolism than say the killer whales. The killer whales live 30 years, but killer whales are very active, whereas whales that are just feeding on the plankton out there in the ocean by just sucking water in through the, they just hang out, right? And they're big enough they don't have to worry about predators. So it wouldn't surprise me that a blue whale has a very long lifespan. But again, the activity level is relatively low. It was a baleen whale. Okay, what helps that? Well, actually, what studies show is if you can lower your caloric intake, that makes a big difference in how long you live. And so actually, it's the thin ones that actually are going to live longer than the ones that are a little overweight. Or seems like it, right? So lowering your caloric intake and lowering your level of activity, that will partly extend your life. But as you point out, is it really worth it? So the question is, what can you do with your life? God has put us here on this planet to spend 70, 80, 90, or even 120 years in some extreme cases on this planet. But the real question is, what are you going to do with the years that God has given you? Hey, before we get into our lesson in Psalm 65, there is a story, a scientific discovery that's been all over the web and concerns the star 55 Cancri. And they have found five planets orbiting this star. You've probably heard about it. And the big news is that the fifth planet they have found is in what they call the habitable zone. And I'll give you a couple of quotes from the scientists who made the discovery. One is Alan Stern with NASA. And he says, this new planet is the first known outsider solar system to spend its entire orbit within what astronomers call the habitable zone. Now, when they talk about the habitable zone, there's actually several habitable zones for a planet orbiting its star. There's what they call the ultraviolet habitable zone, that narrow range of distance from the star where the ultraviolet radiation would not be too intense, but intense enough. But what they're talking about here is what they call the water habitable zone. The water habitable zone is that distance from the star where it would be possible to have surface liquid water on the planet, providing you adjust the atmosphere appropriately. And, if you read the literature, they actually describe this habitable zone as being quite broad, a little bit beyond the orbit of Venus to just a little bit inside the orbit of Mars. But the assumption is that if you're out close to Mars, you're going to have a really thick atmosphere that traps a lot of heat from the sun and therefore warms it up so you could have surface liquid water. Or if you're a little bit closer towards Venus, you make the assumption that it has virtually no atmosphere and therefore there's very little greenhouse warming of the planet and you can have liquid water. But the habitable zone for any given planet is extremely narrow. For example, if we were to move planet Earth 0.4% farther away from the sun or 0.4% closer to the sun, we would no longer have surface liquid water. That's because with the atmosphere trapping the amount of heat that it does, if you move a little bit further away, it's going to drop the temperature a little bit. And when you drop the temperature a little bit, more snow falls. And snow reflects sunlight. So if you got more of the planet with snow and ice on it, that means more heat from the sun is reflected into outer space. And with the reflection of extra heat, that makes the planet even colder than it otherwise would be. And you get what's called a runaway freeze-up, where, you know, as more snow falls, the planet gets colder, which causes even more snow to fall, and eventually you wind up with a snowball Earth, where it's all ice. And all it takes is to move the planet 0.4% farther away to bring that consequence about. Likewise, if you were to move it 0.4% closer to the sun, you get a little bit extra heat. A little bit of extra heat evaporates more water into the atmosphere. When you evaporate more water in the atmosphere, that traps more heat from the sun, and that makes the planet even warmer, and you get what's called a runaway boiling of the water. So the water that the planet would have would either go to steam, or it would go, or vapor, would either go to vapor or would all go to ice. And the remarkable thing about planet Earth is it's exactly at that distance from the sun where you can have lots of liquid water, lots of frozen water, and lots of vapor water, and the ratio of the vapor to the ice to the liquid is stable over billions of years. And the reason why it's stable over billions of years is that we have a creator putting life on the planet and removing other life from the planet so that that life can adjust the greenhouse effect of the atmosphere to keep the planet at the ideal temperature to keep all three forms of water in abundant supply in the Earth. That's critical because the sun is not stable. The sun is getting brighter every year, not by much. It'll take about another 5 million years before you notice any significant warming as a result of the sun getting brighter. But over the course of the 3.8 billion years of life history on Earth, we have the sun literally getting dimmer by 15% as it loses mass. And when it stops losing mass, it gets brighter by 15% as it converts hydrogen into helium in its core. And so our planet has had dramatic changes in the temperature, but that temperature, or in terms of the solar radiation coming in, but the temperature on the surface has been kept perfectly constant throughout those 3.8 billion years by the Creator creating life at just the right time and just the right abundance and removing life that's no longer appropriate, because you can create life that will add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. You can also create life that will remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. And there's two ways that life does it. One way is that life can hasten the erosion rate or lessen the erosion rate. For example, trees and grasses are very efficient in terms of hastening the erosion of the land masses. And what that does is it causes the burial of carbonates into the crust of the Earth and therefore pulls greenhouse gases out. So as the sun's been getting brighter and brighter through the correct introduction of just the right plant life forms at just the right time, you can remove a lot of greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Moreover, when life dies and gets buried, you get the removal of greenhouse gases because you've got life taking up carbon dioxide and water and turning it into sugars, starches, and fats. But it's critical that you remove life that's not efficient for compensation, replace it with life that is efficient. And this must be done on a regular basis, every few million years, you need to be replacing the life that's on the planet. And that's kind of the history of the fossil record. If you look at the fossil record, you'll see that the history of life on planet Earth is exactly what you need to compensate for the changes in the luminosity of the sun. This is an argument we've given at Reasons to Believe for why it can't be blind evolutionary mechanisms. Because blind evolutionary mechanisms would have no idea about the future physics of the sun. But if you have an intelligent creator that says this is what the sun's going to be like in 2 million years from now, and this is the life forms we need on the planet in order to compensate for that change in luminosity. And as you see in Psalm 104, verses 25 and following, it's a property of life to die off that God recreates. God removes life from the planet through mass extinction events and replaces life with these mass speciation events. And that's what you see in the fossil record. You see repeated episodes where millions of species disappear virtually at the same time. And then within 10,000 years or less, or a million years or less, depending how accurately we can measure it, you see a mass speciation event where those millions of species that were wiped out get replaced by millions of new species that are radically different from those that got wiped out. And this happens at least a dozen times throughout the history of the Earth, and interspersed between the really big mass extinction events and the big ones wipe out 50% of all life on the planet. 50% of all the species or more get wiped out. One wiped out 95% of all the species of life on the planet, the Triassic catastrophe. But there are others where only 10% or 20% get wiped out. But it's all such that it perfectly compensates for what's changing in the luminosity of the sun. Now, there was a question somewhere that I missed. Okay, maybe not. That wasn't the discovery I was going to talk about. This planet, let me give you a couple of quotes that have been all over the web, which is why you see these TV news programs about now we're finding solar systems just like ours. Alan Stern from NASA said that this is the first planet, and by the way, they've now found 264 planets outside of our solar system. And I predict that within the next 2 years, the list will be up to 1,000. I mean, literally every week they're finding a couple or more new planets outside of our solar system. But as of yesterday, the list was up to 264. Yes. Well, the Hubble Space Telescope will be replaced by a much bigger space telescope, although there will be a several-year gap between the destruction of the Hubble Space Telescope and what's called the James Webb Telescope. They will not be able to keep the Hubble up until, so there will be a several-year gap between the two. However, the James Webb, as powerful as it is, will not be able to detect these kinds of planets. These ground-based instruments are the means by which they've been picking them up, and they pick them up by looking at the spectra of the star. So it's not the only technique, but this technique is responsible for 90% of the planets that have been discovered, and it's responsible for this discovery, where they look at the spectrum of the star. They can't see the planets, but they can see the star, and what they notice is that the position of the star will move back and forth in the line of sight. It causes a red shift and a blue shift. And so that tells you that the star is being pulled towards your telescope, and at other times it's being pushed away from your telescope. And what would push and pull a star? It would be planets going around it. And by carefully analyzing that push and pull, they can determine how many planets, what the masses of those planets are, and what the distances those planets are as they orbit about it. And 55 Cancri is one of the first stars with which they did this technique. They've been studying the star for 12 years, and that's why they've been able to come up with as many planets as they have. Matter of fact, one of the papers I looked at, you can see in the data that there looks like there's going to be a sixth planet in the system. Five we know for sure, but the evidence is indicating that there's got to be at least one more planet in the system. And it's not at all surprising from an astronomical perspective, because 55 Cancri is what we call a super metal-rich star. It's got twice the abundance of elements heavier than helium than our star does. And by the way, well, let me read some of the quotes, then I'll make some comments on it. As Alan Stern said, this is the first known planet outside our solar system to spend its entire orbit in what they call this water habitable zone. But when they say water habitable zone, they're talking about this very broad zone where you'd be adjusting the atmosphere. Any given planet, the habitable zone, you change it by 0.4% and you're in trouble. But the habitable zone you see in the literature would be, it's about, you could change it by 20% and still be okay. But that means, that's assuming you make an enormous adjustment in the atmosphere of the planet, which of course wouldn't happen for any given planet. That's one quote. Deborah Fisher, who was the lead author on the team that made the discovery, and is going to be appearing next week in the Astrophysical Journal, she said, quote, if there is a moon orbiting this new massive planet, it might have pools of liquid water on its rocky surface. This new planet that they have found is kind of a Saturn-like planet. So I know it was on TV that they found a planet that has conditions that would be suitable for life. Well, it's not in the paper. The astronomers admit that this planet could not possibly have life on it because it's just so massive. 45 times the mass of Earth, a little bit less than the mass of Saturn, and therefore it would have a very heavy gaseous atmosphere that would rule out the possibility that life could exist there. But what they are suggesting is that maybe there's a moon that's orbiting this new planet, and maybe there could be water on the moon. There can't be water on the planet, but there could be water on the moon. And so that needs to be corrected because the TV news stories made it appear that they were claiming, that the planet could have water on it. Not the case at all. None of the astronomers are part of the team were making that claim. And then there's a couple of quotes from Jeff Marcy. And by the way, Jeff's uncle attends this class. Maybe I can find. You want to stand up? He worked with his father. Okay, got it. All right. Right. Well, my parents told me when I was 8 years old that I wanted to get a telescope, I'd have to collect beer bottles in the neighborhood. So we had lots of drunks in our neighborhood, so after 5 years of collecting beer bottles, I was able to get a mirror, and that started my career. Anyway. We don't know. We have no idea. I mean, this is just pure speculation on Deborah Fisher's part that this planet might have a moon around it that could have water on it. I'll comment on that in a minute. But let me give you Jeff Marcy's comments. What he said was, we now know that our sun and its family of planets is not unusual. And this work marks an exciting next step in the search for worlds like our own. Now, that's what's out in the news. In terms of your question, Jackie, is it possible for a moon to have life on it? Well, for the moon to have plate tectonics, which is what you need to have any possibility of compensating for changes in the luminosity of the star, that moon at a minimum would have to be one-third the mass of the Earth. And ideally, you would want it to be exactly the mass of the Earth. Because the bigger the planet, the higher the likelihood you're going to have plate tectonics. But if it gets any more massive than the Earth, then you're going to wind up with a very thick atmosphere. And so identical to the Earth is ideal. But at a minimum, it's got to be one-third. Well, there are no planets in our solar system that are that massive. I mean, our own moon comes up close to the top of the pile. Ganymede and Jupiter, which is about 30% bigger than our moon, it's the biggest one in our solar system. It's orbiting Jupiter. Well, most of the once you get far out from the sun, the moons are not predominantly rock. For example, the moons that orbit Jupiter are predominantly ice. One of the moons is 65% frozen water. Water is the second most abundant molecule in the universe after molecular hydrogen. And so water is quite abundant, and if it's cold, it's going to be in frozen form. So comets, for example, are 80 to 85% water, frozen water. If you're in close, and that is true of this particular planet, this Saturn-sized planet is orbiting close to its star. It's orbiting about the same place that Venus orbits around our sun. And therefore, if a moon's going around it, it would be a rocky moon. It's not going to be an ice moon because it'd be too hot from the star to keep it that way. The problem is to get a moon big enough that you could have a magnetic field and plate tectonics. Without a magnetic field, any atmosphere that the moon might have will be sputtered away by the radiation from the sun. And, that's what's so special about planet Earth. It's the only system in the entire solar system, the only body in the entire solar system that has a strong, long-lasting magnetic field. Jupiter does too, but Jupiter's field varies considerably. And that's what makes life possible on planet Earth, is we have this strong, stable magnetic field which prevents our atmosphere from being sputtered away by charged particles flowing out from the sun and from the center of the galaxy. Yes. Right. Well, let me give you the bottom line, Marlene. The bottom line is life's not possible on the moon. It's got to be a planet. And one reason why it's difficult is it has to be a really big moon. And we don't know of any mechanism that could generate moons of adequate size. Where you could have a magnetic field and plate tectonics, let alone a magnetic field and plate tectonics that lasts a long time. And the other problem is the orbital one that you're referring to. If the moon orbits close around the planet, it will become tidally locked. I mean, our own moon is tidally locked to the Earth. When you look at the moon, it doesn't matter when you observe it, you're only going to see one face of the moon. Why? Because as the moon orbits around the Earth, it's forced so that one face faces the Earth all the way across the orbit. In other words, the moon has a rotation rate of 29 days. It has a revolution rate of 29 days. They're identical. That's tidal locking. The gravity of the Earth pulls on the moon with such great force that it forces one side of the moon to always face the Earth. And that being the case, you would have a moon that would have a very long day. And with a very long day, there's no possibility for life because it's going to be really cold during the nighttime and really hot during the daytime. That's one reason why the astronauts, when they went to the moon in the Apollo program, had to wear a 250-pound climate control suit. And what that suit did is it air-conditioned them when the sun was up and kept them warm when the sun was down. And you say, what kind of temperature variation you're looking at? Well, on the moon, the temperature will vary by 500 degrees between day and night. So, that's a little bit challenging for even a bacterium to withstand, let alone a human being or a mouse. So, now you can avoid that problem by having the moon orbit far away from the planet. The farther away it is from the planet, the weaker the tidal gravitational differential forces. But now if you've got the moon orbiting far away from the planet, then that means there will be certain times in its orbit when it's close to the star and other times in its orbit when it's farther from the star. And now you're going to be going outside that temperature variations within the orbit. And so the combination of those three, a really massive moon, a supermassive moon, and you've got to avoid the tidal locking, or you run into the problem that its orbit is so extreme that the temperature changes from one part of the orbit to the other. Those three would combine so we can rule out moons as a possible site for life, which means that this new discovery is not a candidate for possible life support. However, I think what's got the astronomers more excited is the fact that, you know, our solar system's got 8 planets in it. This thing has 5, looks like 6. For the first time, we found a system that has lots of planets like ours does. However, the masses and the orbits of the planets in this system are nothing like our solar system. The first planet that was discovered on it is a big planet about the mass of Jupiter that orbits close to the star. I mean, really close to the star. It's got a 14-day year. So it's really zooming around. I mean, it orbits inside the orbit of Mercury. And when you got a really big Jupiter-mass planet, and you say, well, how big is Jupiter? Jupiter comes in at 317 times the mass of the Earth. And so if you got a planet that big orbiting that close to its star, it's going to be gravitationally disturbing to the planets that are relatively close to the star. That's a problem. Another planet they have found is one that's 4 times the mass of Jupiter, and it orbits a little bit further away from the Sun than Jupiter does. And that's a remarkable discovery because it's one of the few planets that we have found that orbits farther from its star than Jupiter does. It orbits between, say, where Jupiter is and Saturn is right now. But it comes in at 4 times the mass of Jupiter. And at 4 times the mass of Jupiter, that's too massive. That will gravitationally disturb the orbit of a planet like Earth that could possibly support life. So that's 2 strikes against it. And the other 2 planets in the system come in at masses that are close to that of Saturn, but they orbit in the zone between Mercury and Venus. And if you've got Saturn-type planets orbiting a star in between Mercury and Venus, that again will disturb the orbit of a planet like Earth. So it's got 4 different planets orbiting it that each individually would make impossible the existence on life on a planet that would be like the Earth. Now, I'll give you a 4th strike against it, or a 5th strike. A 5th strike is it's super metal rich. It's so super metal rich that we know this system must be loaded with an enormous amount of asteroids and comets, which means any planet like Earth that's there is going to be bombarded constantly throughout its duration of orbit about that sun. And then a 6th strike against it is a star is the wrong kind of star. It's a much fainter star than our star, the sun. I won't go into the details. You got a question? Well, there's something called the observable universe, which is a universe that we can see. And we can actually observe the entirety of what is theoretically possible to observe. And the limitation on the part of the universe that we can see is the fact that it takes time for light to travel through space. So when we look far away, we're looking not at the universe as it is today, but the universe of the past. And when you look at the universe of the past, you're looking at a universe where the galaxies and stars were closer together, because we've got a continuously expanding universe. So the universe of today is bigger than the universe that we can see, because the universe of today has expanded more than the universe that we actually can observe. But how much of the observable universe we can see? 100%. Well, that was a presumption when they found, I mean, the first planet they found outside of our solar system was discovered in 1995, 12 years ago. And with that discovery, there was the expectation that these extrasolar planetary systems would look like ours. Well, after 12 years of research, there's not a single one that looks anywhere close to what ours looks like. Matter of fact, of these 264 planets, virtually 95% of them are Jupiter analogs. But not one of them has the characteristics of Jupiter that would allow life to exist. You know, in one sense, we have these astronomers pressuring our federal government to give them money so that they can put these space interferometers out there where they can actually image planets like the Earth. But if your goal is to see if there's a planetary system out there with the capacity to possibly sustain a planet like Earth that could have life upon it, all you need to do is look for the Jupiters. And the Jupiters are easy to see. And if the Jupiter isn't right, it doesn't matter whether you've got an Earth-type planet orbiting the system. We already know from the characteristics of the Jupiter-type planet that life would not be possible in that system. And so, of the systems we've looked at so far, not one of them has a Jupiter that's even close. Matter of fact, I have a slideshow. I think I showed it to you some months ago, where I gave you a list of the extrasolar planets that they have found that come the closest to having the characteristics of Jupiter. And when you compare it with Jupiter, you see it's not even close. After 12 years, we have found zero Jupiter twins. After 12 years, well, after 50 years, we have found zero solar twins. See, another condition for life is that the star must be virtually identical to the sun if there's any hope, at least for advanced life. You know, bacterial life, the requirement's a little lower. Yes. Right. Well, in terms of our own Milky Way galaxy, astronomers have determined that about 2% of all the stars in our Milky Way galaxy would have planets. 98% would have none. 2% would have planets. That's still a lot of stars. Because after all, we're looking at 200 billion stars in our galaxy. So 2% of 200 billion, that gives you 40 million candidates, right? Or is it 4 million candidates? Well, I mean, work out the math. That's a lot. Several million could have planets. However, one of the things astronomers have noted is that when we look at other kinds of galaxies, it takes a special kind of galaxy for it to have the possibility of any stars that would have planets on it. The vast majority of galaxies we look at would have no planets at all. So it takes a rare kind of galaxy, one like our own, where you'd have the possibility that you'd have planets in it. For most galaxies, star formation shut down way too long ago for planets to form. Planets form late in the history of a galaxy, and stars aren't forming at that time, you're not going to get any planets. And so astronomers recognize that the Milky Way galaxy is the most planet-rich galaxy that we've been able to see. And again, what I've tried to do in this little PowerPoint presentation of mine is to kind of look throughout the universe to see if we have any Milky Way galaxy twins. And again, it's remarkable. There's nothing close to the Milky Way that has the structure that would make possible the maintenance of any kind of advanced life. There's no Milky Way galaxy twin. There's no local group of galaxy twin. We live in a really unusual cluster of galaxies, and we don't see any other cluster of galaxies that's like our own, the local group, which would make possible the existence of life. We don't see a solar twin. We don't see a Jupiter twin. Now, these people want to spend our tax dollars to look for Earth twins. And, you know, I think that's a good thing to do. I'd love to see what these little small rocky planets are like. But I can make a prediction. I don't think they're going to find an Earth twin. They don't find a Jupiter twin or a solar twin or a galaxy twin, then that would tell us that we can expect they're not going to find any Earth twins either. And then again, you need a moon twin. Earth can't have advanced life on it if there isn't a moon identical to our moon that's orbiting it. Change the characteristics of our moon by 1% or 2%, you eliminate the possibility of advanced life on our planet. One of the books I have in my office at Reasons to Believe is titled, What If the Moon Did Not Exist? And it lists 30 different characteristics of the moon that must be extraordinarily fine-tuned to allow for the existence of life on our planet. So if you don't have a lunar twin, you're in trouble. Everything must be identical. And the stuff that's easy to see, we're not finding any twins. The easiest thing for us to do is to find a solar twin, because stars are really easy to observe. You know, we've been looking at millions of stars, and not one of them would qualify as a solar twin. And I've got a list of the stars that come closest, and none of them are close enough. Yes. Now, that part is fairly normal because that's explained just by temperature. If you're far away, the planet's going to retain light gases. If you're in close, the heat from the sun will blow off the light gases. And so that explains why our planet doesn't have hydrogen and helium, whereas the dominant component of Jupiter and Saturn are hydrogen and helium. Well, yeah, again, it's temperature. If you're very far away from the star, then you're going to pick up the abundant gases. Hydrogen and helium make up 98% of the universe. And so if you're in a place where that stuff's not going to be blown away or gravitationally dissipated, you're going to wind up with lots of that stuff. It's actually the other way around, is that because a lot of these gas giant planets that we're discovering outside of our solar system are orbiting quite close to their stars. And we know they can't form there because it's too hot. Therefore, they must have formed farther out and drifted in. And when we discovered these, what we call hot Jupiters, Jupiter-type planets orbiting close to their stars, then astronomers began to rework their planetary formation models and discovered that they'd overlooked the impact of residual gas and primarily residual dust and rocks. So, for example, if your gas giant planet forms and there's still lots of dust and rocks in the protoplanetary disk, the gas giant planet will gravitationally interact with that residual dust and rocks and drift in. And the planet stops drifting when the dust and the rocks are fully consumed or blown out by the light and heat of the star. So as soon as all that dust and rocks is gone, either accumulated into comets and asteroids and planets or blown out, you're going to get that drifting. And what that tells us is that the four gas giants in our solar system experience very little drift. Something happened in our solar system to get rid of the dust and the rocks in a hurry. And most astronomers now agree that our solar system formed by a very different process than these other planetary systems we're looking at. And one of the unusual things about our solar system is it formed in a really big cluster of stars, bigger than the Orion cluster. So it formed in a cluster where there was at least 3,000 or 4,000 other stars in the same system, and something happened to rapidly kick out our sun, to eject it from the system. And that was good, because if we stuck around in that system, then there would have been no life possible. But the fact that we got kicked out so quickly means that we had the possibility of a radically different formation process for the planets than what we're seeing in these other systems. Again, it's making the point that our Earth is rare and our solar system is rare, had extraordinary birthing characteristics that make it uniquely capable for life. Okay, any more comments or questions on this before we jump into Psalm 65? Yes. Venus's atmosphere is dominated by carbon dioxide and a sulfuric acid. Yeah, not a nice place to go. It's raining sulfuric acid there, and it's also 800 degrees at its surface. Now, when astronomers say it's just inside the habitable zone, what they mean is if you were to push Venus just a little bit further away from the sun and take away all of its atmosphere, you could have liquid water. But what they're ignoring is that the more massive the planet, the heavier the atmosphere it retains. And by that token, our planet Earth should have an atmosphere 2.5 to 3 times denser than than Venus's. The temperature at the surface of the Earth, if everything went normal, would be above 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That didn't happen because Earth received a collision from a planet the mass of Mars, and that collision resulted in the entire primordial atmosphere being blown off into outer space and a very thin atmosphere replacing it. That's one of the extraordinary things about planet Earth. It's a big rocky planet with a very thin atmosphere. But that's exactly what you need if you're not going to have the water become too heavy or the water too dissipated. You need a thin atmosphere, and so that means you got to find some way to get rid of all the gases that it was born with. But in the case of Venus, that's a normal planet. It still has the gases it was born with. And for that reason, it's beastly hot on its surface. In fact, it's even hotter than Mercury. Okay, any more questions, comments? Let's dive into Psalm 65. Psalm 65, it's a creation psalm. That's what we're doing if you're new to the class here, is we're going through the Bible and looking at the 25 different creation accounts that we see in the Old New Testament. And I've lost count as to what number we're on. I'm probably number 8 or 9 in the list. And Psalm 65 has the general theme of how God reveals his existence and his handiwork through the creation and explains how he does it. Now, the first five verses makes a declaration that everybody, Jew, pagan, barbarian, it doesn't matter. Everybody on planet Earth has seen God and has seen his handiwork and can identify his characteristics through what he's revealed in the creation. And actually, King David here, King David is the author of this psalm, so this is written about 3,000 years ago, makes a veiled hint to the effect that it's the Jews that are struggling to see this record in nature, whereas the rest of the peoples of the world are not having that difficult a time of picking it up. And this is something you see in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses is having to berate his Jewish audience for their blindness in seeing what God is trying to reveal to them through the record of nature. But as King David points out, this is a message that goes out to all peoples. That's the first five verses. Then verse 6 to the end explains how it is that God makes his existence, his handiwork, and his character so obviously revealed through nature. And so when you get into verses 6 and following, it explains what it is in nature that so loudly declares who God is and what his characteristics are. So those are the two parts. We'll see if we can get through the first part today. we'll see. Praise awaits you, O God in Zion, verse 1. To you our vows will be fulfilled. O you who hear prayer, to you all men will come. Now it's making a point here that God hears the prayers of everybody, not just those who are believers, but the unbelievers as well. When we were overwhelmed by sins, you atoned for our transgressions. And here he's making the point that the doctrine of the atonement is something you can pull from the record of nature. That too goes out to all peoples. Blessed is the man you choose and bring near to live in your courts. And this is referred to as one of the messianic verses, where King David, amongst other Old Testament prophets, is predicting the coming of the Messiah and of what he will do. And then we continue in verse 4. We are filled with the good things of your house, of your holy temple. And that's kind of a good title for the whole psalm. How God is revealing himself is through all the good things that he provides. And what you're going to see in verses 6 and following, as we look at the record of nature, we not only see that God has provided us with good things, but a super abundance of good things that can't be explained by nature alone. The only explanation for the tremendous superabundance of what God provides, especially for human beings, is that there's a God out there who has created all this and designed all this, in particular for man's benefit, but for the benefit of all life. And verse 5, you answer us with awesome deeds of righteousness, O God, our Savior, the hope of all the ends of the earth and the farthest seas. So it's making the point that all peoples have seen this. And by the way, when he's referring to the seas, King David is one of several Old Testament prophets who's using this in symbolic fashion. If you go through Isaiah and Jeremiah, you'll see that the seas are defined as a symbol. Any of you here recall what that is? We've been over this in class quite a few times. Unbelieving Gentile nations. Very good. That's what the C's are. And in fact, in verse 7, he talks about this God who stilled the roaring of the seas, the roaring of the waves, and the turmoil of the nations. So there you can see that he's, King David, is using this in the symbolic sense. He's referring to the waves and the seas as a turmoil of the unbelieving nations. Yes. It's the plural reference that's referring to the unbelieving Gentile nations. Usually you take it as referring to the sea itself. Okay. Some verses I want you to look up. You who hear a prayer, to you all men will come. Psalm 98, verses 2 and 3. And then I got some verses I want you to look up about how nature reveals the doctrine of the atonement. But let's look at Psalm 98, 2 and 3. Okay, Psalm 98. Sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have worked salvation for him. If you've been attending this church since the 1970s, you'll remember that as a chorus we used to sing frequently in the Sunday evening worship services. But verse 2 picks up the point I want to make here. The Lord has made his salvation known and revealed his righteousness to the nations. He has remembered his love and his faithfulness to the house of Israel, and all the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. So he's talking about how God has made his plan of salvation known, revealed his righteousness known, not just to the Jews, but to the nations, to all nations. And all the ends of the earth have seen this plan of salvation revealed through nature. Yes. Well, there's been dozens, but there's only been three that have been successful in fulfilling any of the predictions made by these Old Testament prophets. By the way, it's interesting you picked on King David. King David made more predictions about the coming of the Messiah than any other Old Testament prophet. Well, for example, look at Psalm 22. The entire psalm is with reference to how this Messiah would suffer on the cross, and actually predicts the words that would be said in mockery to him from believing Jews and unbelieving Gentiles. In fact, there are many people who believe that Jesus was quoting Psalm 22 when he died on the cross. Because how does Psalm 22 begin? My God, why have you forsaken me? And how does Psalm 22 end? It is finished. Well, the first words of Jesus when he was on the cross was, my God, why have you forsaken me? The last thing he said before he died, it is finished. But we also note that there was a Roman centurion watching Jesus die on the cross and heard all those words. And what does it say of that Roman centurion who was in charge of the crucifixion? He looked up and said, this indeed is the Son of God. He believed. And what is it that brought him to belief? Well, if he was familiar with the psalm that King David wrote 1,000 years previously and heard the detail, because what the psalm, you know, you need to read Psalm 22. It's an incredible psalm because it actually prophesies that his clothes would be distributed through the throwing of lots, and that those lots would be thrown by Gentiles, and it was Roman soldiers that threw dice to see who would get different parts of his clothing. That was all predicted, and the style of his death was predicted, namely that he would die from crucifixion. And the marvelous thing about that is King David predicted a death by crucifixion 700 years before the method was even invented. It didn't exist until 300 B.C., and he was writing about this in 1000 B.C. So, but and like, yeah, okay. Let me tell you the two that came closest, because if you go through the Old Testament, you'll see that Jesus of Nazareth fulfilled 107 Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. Now, the one that comes closest amongst what we would call the Jewish fakes in trying to, you know, say that they were the Messiah was Bar-Jesus. Bar-Jesus came a little bit after Jesus of Nazareth. He was able in his life to fulfill 8 of those 107 prophecies. And there was another one who fulfilled 2, the rest of them fulfilled 0. He's a failed prophet as far as the Jews are concerned, because if you go through the Old Testament, there's 323 predictions about what the Messiah would do when he was here on earth. And Jews to this day deny that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah because he only fulfilled 107. Now, you know, we Christians look at it and say there's no way those 107 could be fulfilled unless he indeed was God. And when you look at the 107, you say, this is an incredible miracle. When you look at the 8 that Bar-Jesus fulfilled, those are things you could concoct. But when you look at Jesus of Nazareth, it said that he would be betrayed by one of his followers. And then in the betrayal, he would be sold for 30 pieces of silver, and those 30 pieces of silver would be used to buy a burial field for poor Jews. The prophet Zechariah said that 450 years before the events happened. In great detail, you'll see it in Zechariah. And Jesus had no control over these events. He also had no control over who would be his parents. Well, I mean, he can't be in control of things that happened before he was the age of 2. Well, I think that charge is valid for Bar-Jesus. Bar-Jesus was doing his best to fulfill the Old Testament prophecies. That's why he's rejected by both Jews and Christians. Because it's so obvious from the life of Bar-Jesus that what he was doing is going through the Bible, picking up all these prophecies about the Messiah, and says, well, I think I can make that one work. I can make that one work. I can make that one work. And these tough ones, I'm just going to ignore. But what we notice about Jesus of Nazareth, he made no attempt to fulfill these prophecies. It just happened the way it was. He was born by the parents that was predicted he would be born in, and it said that he would be from Galilee, said he would go into Egypt, that he would be born in Bethlehem. Those are things he had no control over. He had no control over his birth. He had no control over what would happen in his childhood, and he had no control over his death. And most of the prophecies pertain to how he would die. And that's something he had no control over. Whereas Bar-Jesus was simply fulfilling all the easy ones. And he only was able to make 8. And the guy who came in 3rd, I forget his name, he only was able to come up with 2. Jesus came up with 107. And you say, what about the Jews? The Jews are saying, we're not going to accept the Messiah until we see all 323. Well, the irony of Jewish theology is they believe that Elijah fulfills prophecies about him at 2 different times. That he fulfills some of them in one coming and some in the second coming. In fact, when Jews celebrate the Passover, Orthodox Jews, they leave an empty chair for Elijah. Because in their theology, Elijah is going to come back. Now, what I've done with a lot of Jews I've talked to is say, well, if you believe in the second coming of Elijah, what's so difficult about the Son of God coming twice? I mean, if Elijah can do it, then surely God himself could make that happen. And if you look at some of these prophecies, especially in the book of Isaiah, you notice that some of these 323 prophecies are pointing you to 2 different times. If they're pointing you to 2 different times, this is just like the prophecies for Elijah. But the thing I've noticed with many Orthodox Jews, they can see my point for Elijah. Oh yeah, we can see the 2 different time ticks. But they refuse to see it for Jesus of Nazareth. And a lot of Christians have commented on it. They refer to this as the guilty conscience of the Jews. Because with Elijah, nothing's at stake. They didn't kill him. But the problem is, Jews are responsible for killing Jesus of Nazareth, and if they admit the truth that the scriptures are pointing to two different times, then they have to own up to their guilt over bringing down or bringing about the death of the Son of God himself. Now, one way you can help the Jew through that is to say, God had all that planned long ago. And, you know, not all Jews are true followers. And I found when I'm talking to Orthodox Jews, that's pretty easy to get across. Oh, yeah, yeah, we have these liberal Jews today, and they're certainly don't have it right. And I said, well, guess what? It wasn't a whole lot different in the days of Jesus of Nazareth. You had people that were truly seeking after God. In fact, the New Testament mentions some. You know, it talks about these, I'm trying to remember the woman's name, who was a very old woman, who God said she would not die until she saw the coming of the Messiah. Anna, that's right, Anna. And so there were people who were seeking for him, but there were lots of Jews who weren't. And, you know, the thing that really got in the way of Jesus' ministry was Jewish religious leaders. And by the way, I often tell them, it's really no different in the Christian church. What's one of the biggest impediments to Christian ministry today? Certain Christian leaders. It's been that way for 2,000 years. In fact, it's been that way for many more than 2,000 years. And so we say to our Jewish friends, look, we have problems just like you've been having problems for several thousand years. It's your Jewish religious leaders that are really getting in the way of fruitful ministry. But hey, it's the same thing going on in the church today. But our eyes need not be diverted by the mistakes that our leaders have made. Rather, our eyes need to be looking towards those who are true followers of God. And for that reason, many Jews have become Christians. The fellow who heads up our Reasons to Believe organization in South Africa was an Orthodox Jew who came to faith in Jesus Christ. And David Block's testimony is this. He came to the Christian faith through reading all the Old Testament passages his rabbis told him not to read. And he discovered things that said, he found those time ticks. He says, aha, I understand. The Messiah fulfills some of the prophecies in the first coming and the rest in the second coming. Says his rabbis never taught him that particular interpretation. He never even knew that we Christians believe that. When he discovered that, it made all the difference for him. Does this help in any way? Well, that gives you an opportunity to have a wonderful conversation with your Jewish friend about how the Old Testament teaches the Trinity much more pointedly than the New Testament does. Now, that's a myth that's been propagated in Judaism, that the Trinity is taught in the New Testament, not the Old, while the strongest Trinitarian verses are in the Old, not the New. And so, again, as I can use my friend David Block, those are passages he was told not to read. When he started reading the rest of the Old Testament, he realized just how frequently the Old Testament taught the doctrine of three in one, and recognized that the Christians were right and his rabbi leaders were wrong. So, hopefully that helps. There's a question over here I missed. Yes. Well, in terms of apologetics, the Old Testament, well, it does talk about the Messiah. In fact, King David himself, starting in Psalm 2, talks about the Son of God. And, let me just take it back to Psalm 2. I mean, you'd figure every Jew would be, because, you know, Jews do study the Psalms. Although my friend David Block says they were told not to look at Psalm 22. So, But Psalm 2, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against His anointed one. So it's making a distinction between the Lord and His anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say. That sounds like a Trinitarian reference to me. It's referring to God in the plural. And throw off their fetters. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them, then He rebukes them in His anger, terrifies them in His wrath, and says, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son, today I have become your father. So there's a reference to the Father and the Son, right in Psalm 2, 3,000 years ago. Ask of me, and I'll make the nations your inheritance, and the ends of the earth your possession. You'll rule them with an iron scepter. You'll dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest He be angry. So again, a reference to the Lord and the Son. For His wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in Him. Now, when I've shared this with my Jewish friends, I said, well, that's exactly what we're waiting for. We're waiting for the Messiah to come and become the ruler of all the nations of the earth. And until we see the Messiah come and become king over all the nations of the earth, we're not going to believe. I said, well, when you go through all the messianic passages, you see that there's a time when He comes to suffer and die, and there's a time when He comes to rule. He will come to rule, but He first must come to suffer and die. But again, that's a couple of chapters, Isaiah 52 and 53, that Jewish rabbis told their people not to read. I mean, how many Jews do you know have ever been exposed to those passages? So, and that's the one that talks about how He must suffer first, and then He comes to rule. Yes. Right, the Essenes. Well, there is no such thing as the lost years of Jesus. Because if you look at the gospel accounts, it tells us that His parents brought Him to the temple site in Jerusalem every single year. So He didn't go off to India. He didn't go off into the desert of Judea to join the Essenes. His family was bringing Him to the temple literally every year on a regular basis. And what does Jesus Himself say is that, you know, because of the family in which He was raised, every point of the law was obeyed. And one of the points of the law was that if you were a follower of God, you had to go, and you were a Jew, you had to go up to Jerusalem for the Passover. And His parents obeyed that to the letter. They were there every single time. Pardon me? No, there wasn't. A man had the right not to marry. Yeah. No, they. Yeah, Paul was unmarried, and yet he was part of the Sanhedrin, and he was unmarried. So even a member of the Sanhedrin didn't have to get married. So, oh, thank you. I'm way over time. I apologize. So, yeah, I wasn't watching the clock. I was watching all the hands here. So, yeah. Hey, feel free just to stop me. I mean, I know it's going to rain. You want to get home before it rains. And so let's just bow for a quick word of prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank You for an opportunity to dialogue over these passages and really seek out what the truth is being revealed in these portions of Scripture. And thank You, Lord, that You've given us 66 books, not just one book. And Lord, help us to be able to go through these books in such a way that we can integrate and come up with an interpretation that's consistent and literal from cover to cover. And Father, it's so easy to berate unbelieving Jews and leaders in our own Christian denominations who are leading people astray. But Father, let's not look to them. Let's look to you and what you're trying to communicate to us and reveal in our hearts where we're misinterpreting your word. And help us, Lord, to correct our paths so that we may more closely see the truth you want us to understand and apply in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Yes.
Yeah.